ровно год назад случилось крушение рейса
MH17. Год прошел со дня катастрофы малазийского Боинга на Украине.
Россия рассматривает несколько версий этой катастрофы.
Малазийский Боинг сбили пророссийские сепаратисты.
Погибли 298 человек, в основном граждане.
Международный трибунал по расследованию крушения малазийского Боинга на Украине. It was the day Moscow's dreams of empire cost European lives. It was the day the Kremlin lost its last vestiges of credibility. It was the day when it became impossible to continue even pretending that Vladimir Putin's regime was anything close to respectable. It was the day the mask came off. July 17, 2014 was the day Russia effectively became a rogue state. By now we all know the grim statistics. The downing of flight MH17 killed 298 people from 10 countries on 4 continents. 80 of the victims were children. The Netherlands alone lost 193 people, the largest Dutch loss of life since World War II. And Russia made this all possible by, according to all credible accounts, providing pro-Moscow separatists in eastern Ukraine with a sophisticated Buk surface-to-air missile system that could shoot down a civilian airliner flying at 10,000 meters. 1 year has passed since this terrible tragedy, and while MH17 didn't change everything, it certainly changed a lot. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Providence, Rhode Island, is James Miller, managing editor of The Interpreter magazine and author of a new report on MH17 that just came out today. Welcome, James. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you. And joining us also via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umlan, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Welcome back, Andreas.
Good afternoon, Brian.
Good afternoon. It's morning for James. It's afternoon for you and I. Okay, James, we got this tradition, first time on the podcast, first guest, and it's pretty timely since you wrote this excellent report today. Why don't you get the ball rolling by summarizing the findings in the MH17 report you published today? Is there any doubt whatsoever at this point about what happened a year ago and why it happened?
Well, no. Well, you know, here's what I would say. There's no reasonable doubt. One of the sort of incredible things that really struck me as we're piecing together all of these little pieces of evidence from, you know, the stuff that came out literally minutes after the plane went down all the way up until literally yesterday was that so much of it tells the same tale. The evidence lines up. There's so little evidence that's sort of outside of the narrative that has just been growing stronger and stronger. There's no question, you know, dozens of journalists and eyewitnesses and videos place the Buk that you mentioned, this anti-aircraft missile, at the scene of the crime. Eyewitnesses who, by the way, were all very afraid to talk to journalists. This is another theme. Because they're afraid of sort of the pushback from the Russian-backed separatists. They all describe, or many of them describe, seeing the missile, hearing the missile, seeing it going up and actually hitting the aircraft. And then you have the forensics data. You know, the experts who have looked at the debris, they sort of all agree. You know, look, this is a very the Buk has a very distinct signature as a weapon.
Yes, it does.
And it's very different than other options like an air-to-air missile that'd be fired from another jet. And look, this looks like a Buk. And then you have, you know, sort of most powerful is that right off the bat, some Russian media outlets actually reported that it was a Buk. The Russian separatists, you know, Colonel Strokov on his sort of platform that he uses to announce. So it's sort of, it all lines up consistent. A new video just came out yesterday by News Corp in Australia. And it was taken just literally as the separatist, as a separatist commander was coming upon the crash site. And at one point he says, geez, there was a Ukrainian jet fighter and a civilian airliner, and the jet shot down the airliner and we shot down the jet. But then they're looking for the jet remains, and they're not finding the jet remains. And at one point, it would be comical if it weren't so incredibly tragic. Yeah. You know, one of the fighters says, "Well, so where's the jet we shot down?" And the guy says, "It's right there. It's a passenger plane." Mm-hmm.
Watched that video this morning. It's damning.
It is damning.
It's interesting, James, that you mentioned literally minutes, because I remember the atmosphere in the newsroom that day. And when our Ukrainian service alerted us to this, that Strelkov, Girkin, Aka Strelkov had posted on Facebook, if I'm not mistaken, or was it Kontakte? I forget. It was on social media. That, you know, we just shot down a Ukrainian jet. We told them to stop flying in our skies, and we were like, oh my god, we got to authenticate this first of all. But if it is the case, we got to. And I just remember frantically working to get a story out as fast as we could. But at the same time, fearing, like, is this real? Is this real? But from that moment on, literally minutes after, the evidence just accumulated and accumulated and accumulated until, like you said, literally yesterday and the day before yesterday, by the way, when the leak to CNN about the findings of the Dutch Safety Board came out. So your report basically pieces together everything we know to this point that's in the public domain. Is that correct?
I hope that's what we did. We looked at sort of the Russian theories. And look, part of the problem with the Russian theories, and this is what I'm sure you're going to get into because you spoke to it a little bit in your article yesterday, is that the Russian theories are literally constantly changing. So in the last 3 days of editing this piece, they have changed twice.
Twice? they're slowing down.
Well, yeah. I mean, so constantly changing, you know, just sort of everything in them can be debunked. Some of it quite easily, some of it's a little bit more complicated, but, you know, nothing is staying there. And so the sort of the last question is, where did this book come from? You know, did Russia supply this book? Did the separatists capture this book? And I think there's actually a large amount of evidence that the Russians supplied this book. That it was spotted on video that I find convincing on both sides of the border before and after MH17 was shot down. And we also have just this wider pattern. And this is sort of, I think you and I have been maybe looking at this very closely. That's what we do, mm-hmm. right? But the wider media sort of strayed a bit. And so what the wider media maybe does not pick up is that this is almost predictable, that a book would show up in this area in this week, because we saw every week, you know, the Ukrainian military is making rapid advances. And this conflict could have been over. It was getting close to over. And sort of as that realization was hitting Moscow, we see this tremendous amount of military equipment, mm-hmm. some of it quite advanced, some of it that takes advanced training. This is, I mean, we're smart people on this call. None of us could figure out this missile.
Right.
You know, this missile is something that it takes 6 months for you know, Russia's best guys, Russia's best soldiers to train on. That's how long it takes to learn this thing. And that's just to graduate to then testing. That's not to, right. you know, put out in the field. So this is advanced. Where did they get the equipment? Where did they get the guys who knew how to do
evidence
it?
Evidence suggests it came from Kursk. Is my understanding. That's my understanding. You mentioned the massive Russian spin and the crackpot theories, and this is something that just drives me crazy. Because even today, I was reading in on MH17 and some of the stories that were appearing in the media, we're still getting a lot of this he said she said nonsense. The Ukrainian government and the West accuse the separatists, but Moscow says it was the Ukrainians, as if these things were equal, and it drives me to drink. I mean, really, it's infuriating, because, you know, journalism's about accuracy. It's not about balance. And it's still to this day. And that shows the success of what the Russians have been able to do with just spinning these crackpot theories that, to anybody that's paying close attention, are patently absurd. I want to get Andreas in on this. And anything you want to add here, Andreas? A year later, do you have any doubts?
No, I don't have any doubts. There are a few interesting questions still associated with that. For instance, if, as James already indicated, the soldiers who were actually employing this this Buk rocket were not separatists but regular Russian soldiers, then you know, this would be quite something. That would be, in my view, as I see it, a big difference from who actually did this. Then there was also a debate about the Vkontakte site of Strelkov, this social network site. I actually saw the announcement on this site of the shooting down of an Antonov.
I saw that as well on the day. Yeah,
a screenshot of it, because I thought that, you know, that could be taken off soon, and indeed it was.
I took a screenshot of it when I saw it actually live. Yeah, no, because we knew it was going to be taken down soon.
Even if there is a debate about whether actually this Vkontakte account belongs to Strelkov, to Girkin, that means there would be still somebody has apparently reported, even if it's not Girkin or Strelkov, that a plane was taken down. It's actually, you know, it's of secondary importance who did that, if there was somebody, and then it was taken down. And then there is this other aspect that, of course, other planes were shot down before.
Yes.
Before this passenger plane was shot down, and unfortunately that is not not frequently enough reported also by the West. People died before. People were apparently killed with these Russian anti-aircraft weapons, whether Buk or others, before, and that's something that is not frequently enough mentioned. And of course, in general, I think the you know, one has to mention that as tragic as the fate is of these passengers of the airplane, thousands more were killed, a thousand more civilians were killed in this. In this conflict, and the Kremlin bears responsibility for these people too.
Yes, no, I agree with you there. I mean, and why did this grab the world's attention and put this thing center stage? Let's face it, because hundreds of European Union citizens died. That's why, really, and that's what brought this to center stage. Go ahead, James.
And that's what I think was frustrating for a lot of Ukraine watchers. You know, Andrei said it perfectly. You know, we were sort of ringing the alarm bells and saying, look, this is a really serious situation where effectively you have an undeclared war. And this is something I saw someone tweeting about false equivalency in some of these other reports. I was going to say maybe it was you.
It drives me nuts.
it does. But, you know, other civilian aircraft have been shot down in other wars, but it's irrelevant because, you know, this is an undeclared war being fought illegally that Putin still denies he has troops and soldiers and any involvement in, just as he did in Crimea, by the way. And then, you know, 6 months after he annexed Crimea, he said, oh, yeah, those were our troops,
right,
after not denying it all along. You know, Andres makes a very good point about the Strelkov post that maybe we should address a little bit. On a forum run by the separatist commander, they posted right away, moments after the aircraft was shot down, they posted that they had shot down an Antonov An-26, which is a big Ukrainian military cargo plane.
Yeah, it's a transport plane, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, that didn't happen. We know it was a civilian airliner. So this is tantamount to, you know, to admitting that they shot down the civilian airliner. So the question is then, okay, well, is this an official account? That was the first question. And what we know is, yes, it's quite often used. It's quite often cited by the Russian military by the Russian media as sort of, you know, this is the Strelkov dispatches. Strelkov himself is well aware of it. He's never refuted that this is an account that they use. So it's an official account. They're still using it, by the way, although the name has changed. So that's the first part. Now there's sort of a new debate about, well, did Strelkov actually post it? Or is it somebody else?
Irrelevant.
It is irrelevant. And, you know, sort of my point of view is, but the information was very specific, right, that it was an AN-26. So this isn't like somebody just saw, you know, a ball of smoke, and we're like, well, yeah, I mean, and clearly we shot down a military aircraft. They had some sort of specific intelligence, and they put it up there, and the intelligence was just wrong. So there's that part of it.
And adding to that, you had the intercepts by the SBU. Of separatists talking to each other and bragging about this, right? So, I mean, that also is out there.
Yes, so this is great. So basically, the Ukrainian military, the SBU, you know, they released a series of audio, leaked audio tapes, audio recordings, and some of them were up just literally maybe 2 hours, I think, after MH17 was shot down. And these were communication intercepts that they said were separatist commanders, some of whom they say were talking amongst themselves, some they were talking to actual Russian military, discussing a multitude of things. And these tapes came out there, I think there were four of them. And some of the things they discussed were, you know, that there's an airplane flying overboard, you know, are we ready? Oh my gosh, we shot it down. Oh my gosh, it's civilian aircraft. Right. And I should say, no one, to my knowledge, has any credible evidence that a civilian airliner was deliberately shot down. So maybe
that doesn't change the picture one bit.
No, absolutely.
I got a comment on the blog I posted yesterday, my kind of 1 year MH17 piece. Where somebody said it's basically Kyiv's fault because they didn't close the airspace. Well, Kyiv should have closed the airspace. That they should have. But that doesn't change the culpability in this. Just like the Malaysian, as the leaked Dutch safety board reports, lays some blame on Malaysian Airlines for not changing their routes as a lot of other airlines did on that day. That's all true, but that doesn't change the fundamental fact of who is responsible for this and where the evidence points. And this is just, again, more attempts to muddy the waters.
Absolutely. And look, MH17 was flying over a war zone. If I had known civilian aircraft were flying over that area, I would have screamed the day before. It was
right.
It wasn't something I was looking at. But there shouldn't. This is an important point. There should not be a war zone in eastern Ukraine.
Exactly.
This is a manufactured crisis. You know, you look at the polls. There's been a lot of polling before and after. What's interesting now is, you know, the Ukrainian military has recaptured a lot of territory that was controlled by these separatists. And there's been extensive polling done in those areas. And there is no appetite, very little appetite for joining Russia, for being separate from Ukraine. Are there issues? Of course there are issues. But, you know, I have issues with the people in my parking lot. I have not shot any of them. They have not shot any of me. There is not a war here if Russia is not involved in the war. And if you look in this particular, you know, if you go back to July 2014, 1 year ago, the war was ending. And Russia increased support. And that's why it's still going on
right.
today.
I want to go ahead, Andreas. I want to have some things I want to get to you, but go ahead.
Just maybe an addition to that, I remember last year a discussion in German media about this issue of whether the flight zone should have been closed. And there was some argument by experts who said that that would have been actually in contradiction to international experience, because during the Iraq war, during the military operations in Afghanistan, passenger airlines continued flying over these territories because they fly so high that the weapons that are used on the ground, they don't reach them usually. And that would have been probably also the expectation of the Western air companies, right, that there's some civil war on the ground where some sort of small weapons, let's put it that way, are used, but not high-tech Buk missiles, which can actually reach the. I think the height was 6,000 meters in which it was shot. Something
I think it was
like
10,000 actually.
10,000 meters, yeah.
Yeah.
10,000.
And that weapon is the Buk. This is a great point, Andres, because the Buk is such a capable weapon. It's capable of shooting aircraft out of the sky at like 86,000 feet. Nothing, you know, right. I mean, it's very powerful weapon, and you're right, it's interjection into this crisis.
And so if you had indeed a civil war on the ground, I think, you know, this experience applies of other such military operations. And as far as I remember this discussion, there was an argument that over years, big Western companies were flying over Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. There was never any question that if they fly so high that that could be relevant, what is happening on the ground. So I think this blame game here is, you know, after the fact, we always know yeah. better what to do. But back then, at this time, it looked as skirmishes between, you know, local groups, and now we know, of course, that indeed the airspace should have been.
Yeah.
And by the way, also, I mean, it's a financial issue. If Ukraine had shut down this, it would have not received any more the income from the this. And Ukraine is not a particularly rich country.
Andreas, I want to stick with you a bit now, because one of the things I wanted to get at in this segment is the degree to which MH17, what did it change? And I addressed this on my blog this week. One of the things I think it changed was attitudes in Europe towards Russia. I said this in my intro. This is the day Russia lost credibility, the day we had to stop even pretending that it was a partner, although troublesome and tiresome as they may be, somebody we could do business with, into a problem that had to be solved. I mean, was this the day that this changed? And I realize this was building, starting with the start of the Ukraine crisis, the annexation of Crimea. But was MH17 a bit of a watershed? Because I noticed a change in German media, for example, following MH17. I specifically remember a piece in Spiegel that addressed this, this was one of these watersheds where we really have to reassess how we look at this country. How would you assess how this changed attitudes in Europe?
Yeah, I think that was really a crucial moment, because it suddenly made this sort of faraway crisis something of a European issue. And the fact especially that there were Dutch tourists or Dutch travelers on this plane made it something very close. And I mean, you know, one can understand these sort of psychological mechanisms in place here. But also on the other side, of course, it's a bit frustrating that it needed this catastrophe to draw attention finally the European Union to this crisis. I think there's still I haven't fully researched that, but I would be interested to find out how exactly the decision mechanism was, because in the same weeks when this happened in mid July, there was this already starting this discussion about extending sanctions against Russia. And I would be interested to see the sort of exact research on that, whether actually this this catastrophe then influenced the decision in late July to introduce more substantive sanctions. And I'm not yet sure about this. Maybe these more substantive sanctions would have happened anyway, but I think at least for the political atmosphere, of course, this this catastrophe had an enormous significance, and it also finally, I think, you know, made this whole crisis indeed a European crisis. I think the reaction should have been much earlier, much larger, because the so-called Ukraine crisis had already before that, with the annexation of Crimea and the start of the covert intervention in eastern Ukraine, undermined the international regime for non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. So it was actually already at this point a huge issue for international, for one could even argue world security, and it took this catastrophe to bring it finally home to the European public that this is something serious.
Yeah, no, just anecdotally, I mean, I like I said, I noticed the changes in the German media. I also was looking at some public opinion polling yesterday, the Pew Global Attitudes project, and it was very interesting. If you look, like, attitudes towards Russia in 2013 were very positive. They were in the 60% positive. Now this by 2014, they were in the negative territory, and then after into 2015 they tanked, and they're at about 31% in places like Poland. They're in the teens, of course. In places like Greece, a bit higher. But if you go across the Atlantic in the U.S., Russia's like at an all-time low right now. It's like 15% in terms of favorable ratings, according to the Pew. Anything to add to this aspect, James, about how much this changed? You've been following this from the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the attention absolutely changed. There was a sense, there was sort of an enthusiasm about what was going on in Ukraine, from my perspective, in the Western media, certainly in the American media, with the Euromaidan revolution. I think a lot of people were cheering on Ukraine. What's interesting about that is we did a sort of a stock analysis, and the stock market didn't fluctuate. So, Russia's, claims that this was sort of Western imperialism are just nonsense.
Right.
But there was an enthusiasm that, people were standing up for democracy, and there was sort of this optimism about what was going on in Ukraine, and it was immediately tamped down because of Crimea. But even then, what happened was by the time you get to June and the war's broken out in the Donbass, and I think people get tired of the news story and they sort of thought, I don't know. The narrative was not clear, right? Who were these separatists? Are they Russian soldiers? Are they, and then when the headline is, two people died. A little battle, people stop paying attention. And all of a sudden, MH17 was the moment where everybody was paying attention.
Right.
And I think Ukraine has obviously fell from the headlines a bit, but it is still, it has not fallen that far. People are cognitively aware that this is, this is a Russian aggression. Attitudes have changed as far as, you're not seeing editorials about, or you're not seeing as many editorials, at least not in the U.S., about, we need to be softer with Russia. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing that.
Well, yeah, that's one thing I wanted, because it's the debate in the U.S. is a little bit different than in Europe. And the U.S. attitudes towards Russia are traditionally more negative than they are in Europe. And of course, but even that said, looking again, I was looking at the Pew Global Attitudes Survey, even in the U.S., they were above 50% in 2013. And bear in mind, this is after Putin returned to the Kremlin, after people like me who watch Russia for a living began to think, oh, my God, this is going in a bad place, when I thought it might be going in a better place during the Medvedev presidency. And perhaps Medvedev was going to stay, and we're going to have this transition to some kind of managed democracy that could hopefully eventually turn into the real article. I had hopes like that. And I certainly don't think I have any illusions about Russia. But in 2013 in the U.S., after Putin was back in the Kremlin for a year almost, you still had generally positive attitudes about Russia. But then they parallel. They both, Europe and the U.S., the opinions went down kind of in tandem to 2014 to 2015, where they tanked in both countries to around 30% in Europe, 15% in the U.S. What effect do you think in the U.S., because there are Russia apologists in the U.S., or Putin apologists, I should say, in the U.S. They're not ascendant right now, but they're there, and they're out there in the media. How has this changed that debate in the U.S.?
So I think most of it, there are certainly Putin apologists in the United States. I think, not to point a finger at my European friends, but I think there's more over there. There's a lot more business over there.
There's a lot more business, and Europe's a lot closer, so they're less prone to wanting confrontation with Russia, which is to a degree understandable.
Yeah, but in the United States, there is also this sense post-Iraq, really, post-war on terror, Afghanistan. There's a war burnout. There's a foreign policy burnout.
Mm-hmm.
The American people, I think, by and large, would like to see these problems just go away. And there is an attitude expressed by certain American politicians, prominent politicians on both sides of the aisle, which is interesting, both the Republicans and Democrats, who think that, sort of let diplomacy work. It's not our problem. It's not our concern. There is something immediate about airplane crashes in the human psyche.
Yeah.
They make front page headlines in every country and every culture in the world. There is this sense that, wow, that could have been me. It could have been someone I know. And that these were just innocent people flying, and they were also victims of war.
80 of them children.
Many of them children.
80.
Just that absolutely tragic. But I also think what MH17 did was it allowed the world to sort of, let's take a closer look at what Putin is doing. Let's take a closer look at what's going on in Russia. And frankly, what happens is there have been bad headlines almost every day since. You know, what we popularly know is the Russian invasion of Ukraine happened in August. So, you know, the attention was still on MH17, and you're seeing a ramp up of the direct Russian military involvement. Mm-hmm. In Ukraine, so that has sort of those piggybacked on each other and kept Ukraine in attention, and that has done permanent damage to sort of Russia's reputation. But still, the question is, should we be sending? This is sort of where the debate is at in the U.S. Should we be sending lethal weapons mm-hmm. to Ukraine?
Yes.
Not so much are sanctions good or bad. The
consensus is they are.
The consensus is there are. The Obama administration, I think, is hamstrung by its European allies. But should we do more is the question. And it's really come down to arms. The issue with Russia, though, also intersects questions like the Iran nuclear deal or what's going on in Syria, the chemical weapons. Russia's the biggest country in the world. And like the United States, it has it's one of the only countries that has play in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. And so, the question of how hard we stand up to Russia also sort of relates to some of these other questions.
Right, right. But MH17 certainly focused attention and made it much harder to be an apologist and much easier to be a critic. That's how I would kind of put it.
I think it had a massive impact on the credibility, even if it was already strained, of the Russian media.
Right.
In the sense that some of these,
it's the first time I've heard the word credibility in Russian media used in the same sentence.
Yeah, I mean, they were, it's really appalling because they were scrambling to make excuses or to make up lies or make up facts when you have almost 300 people, civilians dead in an instant.
The Russian, as you put it, James, the scrambling to make up lies in the aftermath of nearly 300 people dying. Part of this worked. It created enough seed of doubt and enough low information media consumers around the world to people say, well, maybe it could have been the Ukrainian jet that shot it down, or all these crackpot theories that anybody that was paying attention knew were complete nonsense. On one hand, Russia gained from this, and there's this he said, she said journalism that I see in very respectable media organizations that just say the Ukrainians say this, the Russians say that. We report, you decide. Okay. But they've been successful there. But one of the things I think that where Russia did the real damage to its reputation by doing this was that not only did it become increasingly obvious to people who were paying attention that Russia was responsible for a terrible tragedy, they seemed to be mocking the world and mocking the victims in the aftermath. And to me, that was the United States accidentally shot down a civilian airliner once. The Soviet Union accidentally shot down a civilian airliner once. Both of them admitted the mistake. And in this case, what we had was just this just ridiculous spin fest of everybody from Israel to the CIA to God knows who shot this down when the facts were just coming out rapid fire. This was adding insult to injury, and this is where I think the real damage to Russia's reputation happen. Would you agree, Andreas?
Yes, I think I remember posting in late July 2014 that it might be wise now for the Russian government to close down Russia Today and Voice of Russia and other media outlets, because they become sort of useless, because you cannot, even the spin that they did now becomes something that when we will now have these sort of official reports and maybe a tribunal and sort of official documents coming out, I think the media actually becomes also a problem in itself. So it's a sort of vicious circle in which the Kremlin is in a way now, and that it doesn't make sense to have these propaganda departments anymore when there is something that you cannot really neutralize with this propaganda. And also this whole attitude of sort of postmodernism, where you say, yes, of course, Russia is not ideal, but you see, the US is also not ideal. The right. European Union has its problems. And with this catastrophe, I think this whole sort of playing with this postmodernism has become less legitimate, because there are, children killed. I mean, again, one would have to say that the UN, I think, said that 1.2 million Ukrainian children are in one way or another affected yes. by the war. I mean, this is not the number of the killed children, but children who are in one way or another affected by the by the war. So and this is this catastrophe just symbolizes that. And now I think this whole propaganda machine is a little bit, I would still argue, a waste of money. They should rather put it somewhere else, maybe into weapons or something.
James, any last thoughts on this topic before we switch to the second half?
Yeah, I think that what this did was it gave an insight into how Russia is operating in the world, in even larger, even beyond Ukraine. Russia is sort of fueling these little conflicts, these little fights, they might be political fights, they might be military fights, but it's not taking any responsibility. Russia is still supplying Bashar al-Assad with bombs and aircraft and tanks. Russia is sort of picking at sort of political wounds in Estonia or in Moldova.
Mention Georgia, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia.
Absolutely. And when the United States, when most, all countries make mistakes, but most countries learn from them, or they at very least acknowledge them. There's no secret that the United States invaded Iraq. For better or for worse is an entirely different debate, but the point is that everybody acknowledges that all of the problems therefore sprung from that. Russia isn't taking any accountability here. It's not taking accountability for MH17. It's not taking accountability for what's going on in Ukraine. The Ukrainian economy that was already up against the wall is now, you have the government has to cut spending while simultaneously increasing military spending. Mm. And where does that come from? It comes from food. It right. comes from grandma's pension. Is that Russia's fault? Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
So this is a metaphor for how Russia, that's a good way to put it, and that's a good way to segue into the second section. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at efforts to establish an international tribunal to prosecute those responsible for the MH17 tragedy and at Russia's efforts to block them. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Providence, Rhode Island, is James Miller, managing editor of The Interpreter magazine and author of a new report on MH17 that just came out today. Also joining us via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter @PowerVertical.
despite the criticism of Russia and Mr. Putin and some of the other high-ranking officials in this country since this initiative was introduced, I don't think we should immediately blink an eye because some of the talk that's coming from Moscow. We will see what they will do. And then after everybody has voted, weighed the arguments, everybody has to also be accountable to that vote. And you can rest assured that we will hold all countries accountable to their contribution to solving this appalling tragedy that happened a year ago.
That was Han ten Broekje, a member of the Dutch Parliament, chairman of its defense committee, and chairman of the Dutch delegation to the NATO Assembly, speaking to me earlier today about the proposed Security Council resolution establishing a United Nations tribunal, international tribunal on MH17. The Netherlands, of course, is a big supporter of that resolution and the creation of a tribunal. Malaysia has submitted a resolution to the Security Council on that. As I noted at the outset, MH17 marked the biggest single Dutch loss of life since World War II, and it's not surprising that the Netherlands has been front and center in pushing for an international tribunal and to have one established. Russia, of course, has said it would veto any creation of such tribunal. We'll talk about that in a bit. Also along these lines, leaked details from a report by the Dutch Safety Board this week, the report that's supposed to come out in autumn, have revealed that the investigation is pinning blame squarely on Moscow-backed separatists, saying that they received a Buk surface-to-air missile system from Russia. Let's get this segment rolling, because I spoke to Mr. Ten Broekje earlier today. Let's get this segment rolling by listening to my brief interview with Mr. Ten Broekje, and then we'll take it from there. So let's listen. Thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us today, sir. And first off, I'd like to express my condolences on what must be a very, very sad day for your country. Could you speak a bit about what this tragedy's meant for the Netherlands? It was, of course, the largest Dutch loss of life since the Second World War, after all.
As you say, it's been an enormous tragedy, and the country was shocked and stayed in shock for quite a while. And today, of course, is a day of mourning, where we not only commemorate all the innocent death, not just from our country, but all the grieving nations that have lost, seen lives lost over this conflict in the Ukraine, where the MH17 was downed. So today is a very sorrow day. And in terms of what it means for us, I think it is for the Netherlands also a moment where we realize that the world is not just a vacation or a holiday destination or a place where we do business, but it's also a very insecure place where people can lose their lives over conflicts that were hardly portrayed in our 8 o'clock news.
Now, MH17 didn't change everything, but it did change a lot. And as a ranking member of the Dutch Parliament, as the chairman of your country's NATO delegation, you have a good vantage point. How did MH17 influence attitudes toward Russia in the Netherlands, in Europe in general? Was this a turning point in how European elites and publics view Russia?
Sure. I think this tragedy, combined with the intervention in Crimea and the stirring up in East Ukraine, combined together, mean a watershed moment in our relationship with the Russian Federation. Maybe sometimes that relationship could, before the incident, be described as awkward friendship from time to time. But by now, I feel that Russia is in a very bad way, putting its interest in such a way that it actually hampers and conflicts with the interests of other nations and thus also other people. And it seriously influenced our relations. For example, in the NATO Assembly, of which I'm the chairman of the Dutch delegation, the observer status of Russia was revoked. And in so many other places, we've seen that where we thought we had a détente going on now for at least 10 years, that seems to be going backwards. And I very much regret that, because I think with Russia is a big country, will not go away, and we knew that this was going to be difficult from time to time. But we need to remain in open relationship with that the country. But it takes two to tango here. And what the Russians have done in Crimea only deserves criticism. They're stirring up of the situation in East Ukraine, the same thing. And, of course, the fact that that conflict also produced this horrible outcome with a passenger plane being shot down 1 year ago made this conflict on our doorstep.
And I wrote on my blog yesterday, marking the anniversary of MH17, that July 17th, 2014 was essentially the day Russia became a rogue state. Would you agree with that assessment? Because it's a harsh assessment. I think it's accurate. But on the other hand, as you point out, Russia's big, powerful, and not going away, and it's something we have to deal with. But yet we're in this situation now. How do you square that circle?
I wouldn't go as far as to call it a rogue state. There's many rogue states around the world where there's not central leadership that the Russians have, and I think the state is intact, but it is certainly a state that continues to project its interests also militarily in a way that is in conflict with the treaties that they have signed, with the respect of basic respect for journalists, for freedom of speech, for the rights of minorities. Russia certainly is not advancing. To call it a rogue state, that would be, I think I leave that to you. you can say that as a journalist. I feel that our approach towards Russia should actually contain three elements. We should be firm, flex our muscle if that's necessary, because that's the language that Russians sometimes need to hear. So, for example, in NATO, the exercises that take place in NATO countries surrounding Russia, I think there's all the reason to do that. We should also be firm in terms of the economic power that we can project to further our interests and to protect our interests and those of the countries that seek free trade with us, like the Ukraine, and are free to do so. And economic sanctions combined with the lower oil price certainly is putting Russia in a difficult spot. But at the same time, I also feel that we should remain in diplomacy, in talks, an open hand and stretch hand, because, as I said, it is a big country, and they might be misled by their leadership and their lack of freedom of press. But at the end of the day, we need to live together.
And finally, together with Malaysia, Australia, Belgium, and Ukraine, the Netherlands is calling for an international tribunal in MH17.
Yes.
In a phone call with your prime minister yesterday, Vladimir Putin said this would be untimely and counterproductive. Those are his exact words. And Russia's already indicated that it would veto a resolution, the resolution mm-hmm. that Malaysia's put forth in the Security Council. I've heard talk of all sorts of, I've heard talk of this going to the General Assembly first to put additional mm-hmm. pressure on Russia. I've even read reports citing unidentified Dutch officials saying that the Netherlands may consider sanctions against Russia in the event of a veto. Where do you see this going from here? This is going to become an increasingly important issue going forward.
Yeah. Well, let's take the choice that the GIT countries, the joint investigation team that was formed by all those countries that are involved. So those are the so-called grieving nations, those that have lost citizens on that plane. Ukraine as the country that opened up its airspace. The United States, because Boeing was the manufacturer mm-hmm. of the plane, and obviously also the Netherlands and Malaysia as the co-chair and chair of the flight. Those countries have put together in a remarkable quick span of time the proposal for an international tribunal. And just to remember you, with the Lockerbie tribunal, that was a bit of an old bird tribunal, but it took them 3 years to put together a statute in which those countries work together that formed the tribunal. And this has been done in 3 weeks. It's been a combination of common law and civil law. So it's a remarkable effort that has taken place of the countries. So it shows their resolve to work together and make this an internationally broadly carried initiative. So I think they should put it forward, despite the criticism of Russia and Mr. Putin and some of the other high-ranking officials in this country since this initiative was introduced. I don't think we should immediately blink an eye because some of the talk that's coming from Moscow. We will see what they will do. I mean, they can threat, but it's only when it comes to a vote on a resolution, whether that be in the General Assembly or the Security Council, we will see what they will do. And then after everybody has voted, weighed the arguments, everybody has to also be accountable to that vote. And you can rest assured that we will hold all countries accountable to their contribution to solving this appalling tragedy that happened a year ago.
Okay, I won't push you any farther on that. But I mean, one of the things I've thought about this is that, I mean, this really puts Russia in a tough spot because vetoing this, given everything we know right now, is tantamount to an admission of guilt, no? I mean, it really does look that way. I mean,
we have to be extremely careful, and the reason is obvious, because everything that holds up in my house or in the House of Parliament does not meet the test of scrutiny that is necessary to hold up in courthouse. So when people speak about proof, I'm reluctant to go with that, because I think that proof needs to be established in court and not in the court of public opinion, which is, of course, a parliament where I work. So this limits politicians, but also, I think, journalists like yourself. I mean, we can tout all we want, but at the end of the day, it is in the interest of the victims and those who have lost loved ones that we see this through to the bitter end. And for that to happen, this process needs to be clean, transparent, open, and justifiable and accountable. And if you're too quick with judgment, when you're not the judge, I think that that can hamper the investigation and eventually also the prosecution.
And the only way we'll get to that point is if this resolution passes the Security Council at the end of the day.
I think that is the case, and I think we also need to remember on a day like this. I mean, it's only a year ago, and I mean, apart from two families who have not, and I feel so sorry for them, who have not seen their loved ones who were in that plane being identified yet, but all the others were. So today is a day of mourning, and for many families there will be years of mourning. And I don't know how long it will take for the prosecutors, the international prosecutors, to find the evidence and seek those who committed this tragedy. But you can rest assured that we will, in the Netherlands, we are willing to see this through to the bitter end.
So, yeah, and I am very grateful to Mr. Tom Brokaw for speaking, because I did want very much to get a Dutch voice on this program for reasons that unfortunately require little elaboration. But three things really jumped out at me from that interview. Number one, it's something both Andreas and James, you were doing throughout the program, and I was doing, linking the MH17 as a metaphor for everything that's happening in Ukraine. I think that came through clearly. But also the second, and it's almost where he almost took me to task at the end for jumping to conclusions as a journalist about who is guilty, and we've all been doing it throughout this show. But he's right at this here. Only a court of law can really establish once and for all, finally, who is guilty beyond, you know, to the point where nobody can argue with it anymore. And the third thing that jumped out at me was that we will hold people accountable for their vote, which I found very interesting. Andreas, what jumped out about it? What did you see there that jumped out at you?
Well, the somewhat awkward aspect of all of this is that the Netherlands are one of the big trading partners of Russia. And if you look at the composition of the Russian state budget, then foreign trade, in particular the export of energy, plays a major role, a larger role in the Russian budget than in many other European countries' budgets, and that the Netherlands are indirectly one of those countries in the European Union that are co-financing this whole madness in Eastern Ukraine. And
you mean as a result of their trade with the Russian Federation?
Yes, because the Russian budget and the Russian economy is such that it very much, it's built on the export of, in particular of oil, but also of gas and of other, and the EU is the largest, by far largest foreign investor in Russia. So all this is a strange contradiction. And if the EU would not have as close economic relations with Russia, Russia may have simply not, would have not had the money to do what it does in Moldova, in Georgia, and in Ukraine, because it would be busy to fulfilling its obligations towards its own population in terms of pensions and stipends and medicine and so on. And we are part of this whole story because we are trading with Russia. Still we are trading even after the introduction of the sanctions on a large scale. And that is, I think, something that politicians like the one you interviewed may want to reflect upon. Mm-hmm.
James, any thoughts from you?
That was a great point. You know, Russia is operating. Mr. Broca talked about sort of Russia's promise. You know, he said that, you know, at one point Russia is a huge country. It really should be. It should be an active member of the international community. But Russia is operating on this sort of, on a most fundamental level, on something I call the zero-sum game. And this is the idea that somehow, you know, if Ukraine joins the European Union, or if the European Union expands, somehow good things for other countries are bad things for Russia. This is sort of the antithesis of the entire idea of the European Union. It's the antithesis of the entire idea of I think most of the globe at this point. But you know, Russia is sort of stubbornly entrenching itself in this sort of situation where it is sort of fiercely trying to hold on to its spheres of economic and political influence. And what's happening is backlash. It's not working.
Right.
You know, the European Union is Russia's biggest trading partner, but you know, and now that all of a sudden that's a problem. I don't think that was a problem years ago, but now it is a problem because now the European Union has to ask questions like, well, you know, what will Russia do to those trade negotiations? What, you know, will it shut the border like we've seen it shut the border with some countries? You know, will it limit certain imports or exports if it feels economically threatened? It's Russia is constantly looking outwards right now and is sort of very reactionary instead of dealing with its own problems. And that is sort of, the best example of this is what's going on in Ukraine.
What about the point that Mr. Broca made about the International Tribunal? That we can, I mean, you can write reports and I can write reports and have all we want and we can gather all the evidence. And it's so obvious to us what happened. And I think, quite frankly, it's quite obvious to him as well. But, until this is proven in a court of law, beyond a reasonable doubt, there won't be closure on this for the victims, of course, number one. But in number two, this narrative won't be there won't be closure on this narrative. There'll still be this seed of doubt. I mean, if you think back to the Yugoslav crisis, now I this week for the first time on mic I used the phrase Srebrenica genocide. Instead of saying Srebrenica massacre, I said Srebrenica genocide. And why did I feel comfortable doing that? I felt comfortable doing that because there are numerous court rulings classifying it as such, right? I didn't have to hedge. I didn't have to hedge. And if you have an international tribunal on this, you're going to have the same thing. We won't have to hedge and say things like, well, according to all the evidence, it's certainly beyond, you know, we will have this is why a tribunal, I think, is extremely important. That's number one. And number two, I think Russia's in I put this question to Mr. Broca, Russia's in a tight spot here. Because for all Mr. Putin could talk all he wants about how this is untimely and inconvenient and so on and repeat the talking points that we heard Churkin make in the United Nations when this resolution was introduced. But if Russia vetoes this with everything that's out there in the public domain right now, it is tantamount to an admission of guilt, I think. I mean, really, why else would you not want a tribunal?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, to your first point about the evidence, you know, look, you and I and everybody in this conversation, the journalists out there, and frankly, a lot of the policymakers, we are only able to look at what we have access to. You know, we don't have the kinds of
investigative powers. You don't have subpoena power.
Yeah, no, we don't have subpoena power. You know, I can look at, you know, I mentioned the analysis of the debris fields. But, you know, there has to be an actual analysis of the debris fields. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking to experts who are analyzing the photography of the debris fields. And some of them have more access than that. But it's not the kind of investigation that you would see in an official investigation. So, you know, Russia should welcome it. You and I know they're not going to. You know, let them veto it. And this is a point, you know, when we get to what we do, what the rest of the world does. My concern here is that Russia is going to threaten to veto it and it won't put up for
that
a
is
vote.
That's my great fear too. I want this to go up for a vote.
And yes, absolutely. And you know, in the if you look at the way Syria is being handled or Ukraine is being handled, the world continues to stress, the international community continues to stress, the European Union, the United States continues to stress, well, diplomacy is the only solution. And I do believe that. But at the same time, you have a player at that table. The primary player at the table in both of those conflicts is Russia, as far as the diplomatic side of it goes, and in Ukraine in terms of probably all of it. And Russia is fundamentally dishonest and about both of those conflicts, about this issue, MH17. And the international community, I feel like, is hesitant to say, well, let's put this up for a vote. Let's let Russia use its veto power. Let Russia display exactly where Russia is on this issue.
Well, we just had a test case. I mean, I don't know if it was a test case, but a case that kind of with the Srebrenica resolution. Remember, Great Britain put a resolution before the Security Council condemning in the strongest possible terms the genocide at Srebrenica of Srebrenica, and Russia threatened to veto it, and it looked like for a time that the resolution wouldn't be presented, but they went ahead and submitted the resolution for a vote, and Russia did veto it. And to me, that was, God, what a telling moment. You know, they were forced in a bad PR moment, I might add.
Because, yeah, that's right. And if I were a European partner, if I was a business operator in Europe, and the question is, well, are we going to do business with somebody like this? Are we going to do business with somebody who uses their authority in the international community to just put their foot down and stop a process like an investigation into what is effectively a mass murder case moving forward? You know, to me, that would disquiet me as an investor. Mm-hmm. And I think this is happening, you know. But yeah, let Russia show where Russia is at on this issue definitively.
Andreas, your thoughts on this, on the tribunal, the potential of a Russian veto, and the potential aftermath of or fallout?
Yes, I think there will be a veto by Russia, and because it will then, because Russia will then be, the Kremlin will be able to fall back on this position that, well, there are lots of private opinions and journalistic reports and all sorts of NGOs and governments who say this or that, but there is no third party decision or no third party resolution on that. So I think one has to start thinking about plans B. What does one do once indeed the decision is vetoed, and whether there are other international organizations like the Council of Europe, maybe other international courts to which the victims could turn, and the relatives of the victims could turn, and maybe another format to have some sort of internationally supervised process that would then come to a resolution that would have maybe not as much authority as a UN tribunal, but at least some sort of authority. I think what the Kremlin might be fearing here as well is that if the relatives of the victims of this catastrophe from Malaysia, from the Netherlands, and so on, get somewhere with their claims, then this could provide then a model for the relatives of the thousands of more victims in Ukraine of the Russian covert intervention, and that thousands of Ukrainians may then turn to international courts, to some sort of international organization, and have their claims heard there. And there's now the story has come out that apparently Russia is preparing a complaint by several thousands of Ukrainian citizens who will go, as far as I understood, to the European Court of Human Rights and try to put a complaint against the Ukrainian government, because
well, this is classic cloning. This is what they do. They do exactly what the other side is.
The issue is here that, of course, these Ukrainian citizens, they, in order to be heard in the European Court of Human Rights, they would first have to turn to Ukrainian courts and have to be unsuccessful in Ukrainian courts when they are complaining about Ukraine, and then they could indeed turn to the European Court of Human Rights. But here we have a different situation that that it cannot be expected from Dutch people or from Malaysian citizens to turn to Russian courts to file a complaint with a Russian court. And this would be then a mechanism also, or could be a precedent for Ukrainian citizens who cannot be expected to turn to Russian courts to file their complaints. And then they could maybe turn to an international court like the European Court of Human Rights or an international tribunal or whatever organization it may then be. And this could be then an example just for many more complaints against Russia. And that might be an additional reason why the Kremlin will, I think, use every possible mean to any possible instrument to prevent some sort of court proceedings on the catastrophe.
I mean, one of the reasons I think that they are determined to not let this happen is because, and James, you pointed to it earlier in the show, there's a good chance that it was Russian soldiers operating. Andreas, you mentioned there's a good chance that there were Russian soldiers operating that Buk, not Ukrainian separatists, and that if these were Russian regular troops that shot down this plane, well, guess what? Where does that point the direct culpability to? I mean, suddenly, if that happens, Putin becomes Milosevic.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so what's interesting about the Buk, the missile that's in question, is it's designed to network with large systems of communication and radar systems. So it's capable of shooting down aircraft. That's not the question. The issue is it was designed to make sure that it was shooting down specific aircraft, or it was seeing the aircraft coming, and it was also designed to make sure that there were fail-safes in place. And what's happened is that all of this military equipment that's in Ukraine is absent of all of... It's absent of the oversight. It's absent of the culpability. Who's in command? Who's in control? And it's not clear. And, you know, even if these were Russian troops, you know, if they were, if this was a formal invasion, okay, this would not have happened because those Russian troops would have known, they would be in constant contact with their military command up the chain, and that military command would have known that that was a civilian airliner. Why isn't that communication there? Well, because as we see, it gets intercepted, and then, oh, well, the cat's out of the bag. I think that what happened with MH17 has destroyed a whole series of international laws and international order, and what's happening in Ukraine the same way, you know, by allowing Russia to sort of put their foot down to block a process like a tribunal on an investigation that they claim, you know, on an incident that they claim they have nothing to do with. Mr. Broca talked about nuclear proliferation. It is very important, and maybe a lot of people may forget this. Ukraine had nuclear weapons.
Yes, they did.
Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons, and they gave up nuclear weapons in a series, really, of treaties with Russia that were designed to ensure that what is happening today did not happen. If Ukraine had nuclear weapons, would we be seeing what we see? I don't think so.
Probably not. What about the last thing before we wrap it up? Throw this to both of you. I mean, there's been talk, I mean, leaks in the press from unidentified Dutch officials saying that the Netherlands might consider additional sanctions against Russia in the event of a veto. The farthest Mr. Broca would go in this is that we will hold everybody accountable for their vote. Andreas, what do you think? Do you think that a vetoing something like this could move the European Union into going to the next phase of sanctions?
Maybe, but for the European Union to make a decision on this, unfortunately, you need 28 countries to veto it. And while the Netherlands may introduce additional sanctions as a country, I'm afraid that, I mean, we know basically already what we know, and this vote, this probable veto in the Security Council by Russia will not change much. So I don't think it will really change the overall composition of opinions in the EU. And while the Netherlands may try to push for further sanctions, I'm afraid for the time being I don't see that happening. I think that the question that will always be put on the forefront is, should we extend actually the current sanctions? That's where we are right now. But at least I think there is now an awareness, I think, in the Kremlin that if there is a new escalation in eastern Ukraine, if, for instance, Russia will try to create a land connection from the Donetsk Basin to the Crimea, then there would be a new round of new sanctions, and I would expect much more serious sanctions. And in that way, I think this whole process around MH17 may send additional signals to everybody and may actually soothe and calm the situation in eastern Ukraine somewhat.
James, last word to you before we wrap it up as we're pushing up against the end here.
Yeah, I guess my question really that sort of nags me is, if MH17 didn't change everyone's opinions, then what possibly could? You know, so if Russia's going to block the tribunal and that doesn't lead to more sanctions, what could possibly happen
that would
spark more action from the European Union is really what we're talking about.
All right. And on that note, we will wrap it up. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Providence, Rhode Island has been James Miller, managing editor of the Interpreter magazine and author of a new report on MH17 that just came out today. Also joining us via Skype from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for joining, and a big thanks to Han Ten Broke for joining me earlier today. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.